Okay, so they're now recording and we can share the screen and kick off. So again, my thought was that this is hopefully going to be very useful again at some point. Also thought it was nice, you know, to sort of dream a little bit while we're doing this. And then, of course, after today's announcement, maybe, in theory, the dream seems a little bit closer, but we don't really know, don't really have any clue. So anyway, so we'll start by sort of talking more of a theoretical standpoint with regards to cashiering, and then we'll go into more specifics in terms of general cashiering, and only then move on to the holidays at the end. So it's sort of, it's almost like two parts. But I think that they are connected, and I think it's important to sort of go through them if we can. Make sure I'm on the right thing. There we go. All right. So we'll start from the very beginning. Okay. The Torah does talk about kashering itself. Torah talks about the spoils of war after there was an attack from the Midianites, and then the Jewish people obviously ended up with a lot of extra utensils. So it talks about exactly how these things have to be kashered. And the Torah says that basically anything that went through the fire has to be purified through fire, has to be kashered through fire. Anything that was went through water has to go through water. And again, the pasuk is a little bit difficult to figure out, but based on the Torah Shabbat Peh, we come out with a principle which we'll come back to later called kabolo kach polto. So however the taste was absorbed, however it went in, that's in a sense the same way that it has to come out. Okay, so that's basically the principle that we're going to be working with throughout all of this. Okay, so in terms of figuring out a utensil, so now we've got something in front of us, we're pretty sure it's not kosher. Last week we figured out, hopefully it is still kosher, right? Maybe we've sort of avoided the problem altogether, but now we're pretty sure this is a problematic utensil. So what are the factors that we need to consider? Basically three factors that we need to think about. Number one is the material. The material that this utensil is made of, is it made of metal? Is it made of earthenware? Is it China? What exactly does the status of China have of the material, China? Porcelain, I should say. Glass, right? All those sorts of things. What exactly is this made of? Number two is what exactly has been absorbed. So when I say that, I mean, sometimes we're talking about meat, right? A meat utensil which has absorbed milk into it. But we said last week that you can end up with a bit of a funny utensil which hasn't actually absorbed anything non-kosher, and it hasn't even absorbed milk and meat mixture. It has absorbed milk, you know, at a certain point. It's absorbed meat at a certain point, and that may be a slightly different status. We're talking about chametz, right, for Pesach. So what exactly has gone in? So that's also going to be a factor. And number three, of course, that takes us back to what we just mentioned, which is how exactly has that happened? Was it done in boiling water? Was it done in an oven? Was it done over an open fire? Was it done just by a spillage? Right, all these sorts of things. So how exactly was it absorbed? So those are basically the three key factors that we need to bear in mind when we think about how we're doing. Okay, so let's start with the first one. First one is that as a general rule, only things which are metal or metal types are going to be kashered. Nowadays, big questions of, okay, so before we get to glass, which I'll mention in a moment, before we get to glass, big questions are also about plastic. And I believe that in most situations, we tend to be lenient with regards to hard plastic and things like that. So again, there aren't many hard plastic utensils that people have, but things like an urn, right, sometimes needs to be kashered for Pesach, things like that. So we tend to be lenient on hard plastic. But things like china, right, ceramics, all those sorts of things, we definitely don't kasher. Sorry, not definitely, never say definitely. But as a general, we don't really kasher them. And glass also, the Ashkenazi practice is generally not to kasher glass. The Sfardim, I believe, do. Now, we'll come back to glass in a moment because there's a few different questions when it comes to glass. One is whether it needs anything altogether, right? So again, there are a number of leniencies when it comes to glass, but as a general rule, we tend to avoid kashering it. We tend not to use it if it has been used for non-kosher. But as I said, that there are definitely more leniencies with regards to glass than there are with regards to earthenware. So, as I said, we have definitely can kasher metal, Most concassia, plastic, glass, generally not, and earthenware, we'll say a blanket no for now. As with all these things, if there are specific questions, you can always be in touch with me afterwards, but those are the sort of general principles.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's in terms of the material. Is that a question?
Yes, one question, Rabbi, apologies.
Already? I haven't even started.
We're talking specific, when you say you can be kashered, cannot be kashered, you're specifically talking about, say, inheriting utensils or getting utensils that have been used for non-kosher purposes, rather than something that has accidentally had something in it, in a sense. Reversing, a previously kosher, milky, utensil which some, meat went in it or something.
Generally talking about anything at the moment. As I said, we're moving on to factor two now to talk about what exactly has been absorbed. But we're not, it doesn't really matter whether it was, I'm not sure if you're drawing the distinction between intentional or unintentional, that doesn't really make a difference. In terms of what has been absorbed, yes, it may make a bit, may make a difference. That's what we're moving on to now. All right, if there's still a question at the end of this section, you can come back to it. So what has been absorbed? So there's quite a significant distinction drawn in halacha between what we call Hetera Bala and Isura Bala. So when something absorbs something that is prohibited, rather than when something absorbs something which is permitted, but then in a sense that becomes prohibited as a result. So for instance, right, the example we spoke about last week, your milk spoon went into your chicken soup, right? Now the chicken soup was kosher, the spoon was kosher, but of course we don't mix meat and milk. So that is called hetera bala. That means it absorbed something that was kosher. Now it's true that as a result of that, you now cannot use this spoon, but that does have a lower level. That is, we do generally tend to be more lenient with regards to that. Now, again, it does need to be a little bit case by case, but as a general rule, something which has absorbed real non-kosher is more problematic than something which has absorbed milk or meat. And with chametz, it's a bit of a debate, but we tend to be stricter, but there are those who are more lenient with chametz as well, who say that the chametz that was absorbed was also kosher, right? Everything is kosher. We're just at this time of year, it happens not to be. So that is a significant debate. But again, our general principle is to be strict with that. But again, when with all these things, we get multiple factors coming in, and that can often be used as a factor towards leniency as well. Okay, so what's absorbed, I would say, is probably the least of the is the least significant of the three categories when figuring out whether to kasha, but it does factor in, so I thought it was important to mention. And number three, and then as I said, we'll pause after this if anyone has any questions. Number three, I think, is really the most important one, and that is kabolo kach poltos. As we said before, things which are absorbed in a fire should be removed by fire. Things which are boiled have to be boiled, and things which had which were absorbed by something being poured onto them or spilt onto them can also be kashered by having something spilt onto them. So, for instance, right, we have a pot that was used to, let's say, cook something non-kosher, right? It was cooked a non-kosher soup, for example, right? You realized afterwards, for whatever reason, right, or someone has cooked a non-kosher beef stew, let's say, in your pot. What can you do? So if you boil up that pot with boiling hot water, okay, and again, let it bubble over the side carefully, then that would kasher it, right? It's been boiled, something has been boiled in it, something has been cooked in a liquid inside this pot. So you remove that non-kosher taste by boiling that over. Now, something which has been cooked without liquid requires a significantly higher level of kashering, things like ovens, things like, it's potentially cutlery, but usually not. We'll come back to that. And again, things which have spillages, things which have become non-kosher through something that has spilled out over them, generally will just require boiling water to be spilled over. This is all the theory. As I said, we're going to move on to more practical examples in a little bit. But I just think it's good to start with that. Okay, any questions on the theory before we move into sort of applying it into more practical? Dad, did that answer the question? The later part?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Great. Silent here. Okay, so next. So how do we catch it? So again, this comes back to, so the slide before we said, yes, it depends how it's absorbed. So now we're going to go through the three main ways. Okay, there are more than, you can subdivide it slightly differently, but in principle, we're going to now divide it into basically three main types of caching. Number one, I've done it in really order of severity, but I would say number two is the most common, probably. But number one is what we call Libran. Okay, now Libran literally means burning hot. It's really, really burning hot. This is the classic blowtorch, right? Which we'll come back to a blowtorch a little bit later on from the more practical perspective. But what it means is that something has absorbed without liquid. Yeah, okay, so it's absorbed without liquid, without significant liquid. Something like shallow fried, some often also requires Libran. And this requires Libran. So now, what exactly is Libran is a great, great debate. Some say that Libran just means that you have to have it to the same level as it was. So for instance, your oven goes up to, for argument's sake, 280 degrees, right? 270, 280 degrees, for example. So as long as your oven gets to that temperature again, then that's enough to sort of expunge the taste that has gone in. Others say that, so that's what we call Libran Kal. So this comes back to the sort of split in number one. Some say Libran Kal is enough, that as long as getting back to the level that it was earlier. Whereas others say, no, once you are cooking something, you need to have real fire, needs to be burning, burning hot, needs to be a much, much higher temperature, talking about hundreds and hundreds of degrees, and that is much, much more difficult to do. Something like a self-cleaning oven does reach that temperature when it's in that self-cleaning cycle, but otherwise, it's or a blowtorch, right, as you said before, also would sort of usually reach that sort of temperature. There's a general rule, it's quite difficult to do Libran Chomer, quite difficult to sort of do that, and that either means that we're not going to kasher that, whatever it may be, or we're going to have to be a little bit lenient and go with Libran Kal, which again, we'll come back to sort of the types of vessels and utensils that we're going to be using this for. But basically, those are your really two options when it comes to Libran. When it comes to Hag'ala, so when it comes to boiling something in water, that's relatively straightforward, as it ends, right? Something that was used with liquid needs to be boiled up, but this is something that was on the fire with liquid in it, right? Like a chicken soup, like a, like you said, a beef stew, like something like that, like an urn, right? There's another good example, an urn for Pesach, assuming that you think it, you know, could have had, some people warm up their challah rolls on top of the urn, some people get a few crumbs inside, okay? So that's going to be where you potentially had a little bit of chametz in your urn or something like that, again, boiled up with the fire exactly on in it. So what you need to do in order to kasher it is, again, is to boil it up with the liquid inside of it. Irui is a lower level than that. So irui means spilling the water onto something. So you take the kettle and you splash it off. So just to clarify, when it comes to a pot, you cannot pour boiling water into a pot to kasher it because the pot was on the fire. That's number two. That's Hag'ala, right? Number three is pouring on. Pouring on will work for something that just spilled on. So let's say we'll come back to the stove top, right? Around the stove top where you may have had spillages, right? So assuming you, well, maybe it's not a great example actually because they tend not to eat up there. So a lot of people are more relaxed about that anyway. But let's say, I had this question recently, okay? A thermos flask, right? No one cooks in the thermos flask directly. You pour something hot into it, and so in order to kasher it, you pour boiling water into it. Okay, so into it again, that's level three, lower level for the lower level type of absorption. Okay, and as I said, that in principle, those are basically the three types of kasher. Okay, any questions? Great, doing well. Yes, Steve.
Yeah.
Going earlier on, you were saying that there were certain materials and certain items that couldn't be kashered. Can you expound on that just a little bit? I think you said earthenware and Pyrex and so on and so forth.
Right.
Does that mean they can never become kosher?
No, they've never become kosher.
As a general rule, yes. I would say in cases of great need, then it's worth asking the question. So there are circumstances under which we do. But as a general rule, yeah, we try not to kasher these sorts of things. I mean, classic examples are things like, I'll give you one example that's discussed among, Moshe Feinstein, for instance, who's a great halachic designer of the last century, has a long piece where he discusses a family who becomes religious, right? But now they're not overly wealthy. He says, do they have to start again with all of their cutlery, crockery, et cetera, so he has a whole system for them to kasher their crockery. As I said, as a general rule, we tend to avoid it. That would be considered a case of great need. And as I said, for more specific things, I think it's always worth asking. But generally, we don't kasher earthenware, glass, those sorts of things, ceramics, all those sorts of things. In terms of countertops, materials for countertops, we'll come to that a little bit later on. We'll come to that a little bit later on. Okay, any other questions? All right, so let's go through. So let's go through some of the things around the kitchen. Okay, so some of the things around the kitchen, now we're going to come back to this. So let's say, for instance, you have your hob, right? Your hob. Now we're going to be talking about, okay, so when we come back to holidays, right, we're talking about real non-kosher having been on the hob, potentially. But let's say we're talking about just, you know, either a mistake or we're talking about for Pesach, right? So for Pesach, you want to kasher your hob, you want to use it, so we clean it very well. And then now this is something where the food, right, even though it's on the underside of the pot, yes, it's true, we're not eating off the hob itself, but although it's on the underside of the pot, we do assume that the pot will then become non-kosher and the pot has the food in it, so that's obviously no good. So therefore, you have to kasher the grates as well. You do that by simply turning it on, right? By turning it on, by making them hot. The easiest way to do this is to put a pot on the top of it once they're clean already. So you put a pot on the top of it, and that sort of spreads the heat out over the whole hob or over that one ring. And that you leave that for about 20 minutes. Gets very hot. You can, in theory, do this for all four rings at the same time. I find that it all just gets a bit too hot. The whole area gets a bit too hot. So I tend not to do, just from a practical perspective, tend not to do more than two rings at a time when I'm kashering them. And always put a little bit of water in the pot as well, because otherwise your pot will burn, right? So just put a bit of water. That's not from a kosher perspective. You can just put a sheet of metal on the top. But from a practical perspective, you put a bit of water in your pot when you're kashering them, and again, that stops the pot from burning. So these were classic electric, you know, the ones that actually turn red hot, the electric ones, or the classic gas hobs. And those are the simpler ones. Of course, nowadays we have all these great new inventions, like induction hobs and things like that, which are great inventions most of the time, but they do raise a lot more questions when it comes to some of the challenges with kashering and things like that. So as a general rule, the ceramic tops, right? So I think this is sort of the older style. This is not the induction hob. And I believe actually that a lot of these change with time. So it's worth looking into each one. This information may be slightly out of date. It's always worth checking your specific sort of your specific model, but generally speaking, the classic ceramic ones, which do get quite hot, right? Again, you turn them on, make sure that they're glowing, make sure it is getting hot, and again, putting the pot on the top as well. Ideally, we again try to pour a little bit of water around. If you think it's safe, you think you're not going to break anything, then try and pour a little bit of water around the sort of the edges and the sides and things like that. For Pesach, some people cover around the sides. Again, with all these things, one should be safe and careful. But in principle, the main thing is obviously the part where the heat is, the part where the actual element is, where it's actually getting hot. That's where the food would be. And as long as it's clean and it's heated up to that temperature, then that would be considered libun hal. That would be considered, as we said before, that's a lower level of burning hot that would sort of expunge the taste. Induction hobs are difficult to kasher, and I'll leave it at that. It's, as a general, we try not to kasher induction hobs. When it comes to Pesach, there are ways around it. But if you have an induction hob and you really do need to kasher it, then easier to talk about the specifics outside. Difficult to have sort of general principles other than avoid if possible. But as I said, okay, when it comes to holidays, we'll come back to that. Right. Microwaves. So microwaves, some like kashering them, some don't like kashering them. So I've done the easy thing here, and I've gone with the OU suggestion. The OU is an excellent organization, excellent kashrut organization with top halakhic designers, you know, leading the organization. So I think that their suggestion is a very good one. We personally tend to not kasher a microwave, but this is a very good way. Very good way to do it. So I think it's important to sort of put it out there. The challenge with microwaves actually, they do produce a lot of steam and a lot of liquid, which is important obviously to get out. So they recommend putting a cup of water in there for 10 minutes, okay, and letting that all really steam out the whole microwave. Then opening it, moving the cup to a different location so that the area that was the cup was covering is also going to be going to be kashered. I'm doing the same thing again, a new cup of water inside. Now again, when you come back to glass, it's the same thing. So the plate itself is considered to be non-kasherable by Ashkenazim, and therefore should ideally be replaced or double wrapped. Now we're talking about cases where you really really need to use the microwave, and you really need to kasher the microwave. If we're talking about sort of more long-term solutions, then again, one could potentially be lenient on the glass question and simply kasher the glass in the same way as has been done, or sort of find other workarounds. But in principle, the glass, we wouldn't kasher, but everything else would be kasherable with this steam, simply by heating it up for 10 minutes in two different locations in order to ensure that all of the microwave gets hot with this steam that is building up within the microwave itself. Okay. Metal utensils we mentioned last week, and we'll mention again, that they simply need to be put in a pot of boiling water. Relatively simple to do, you know, got to do it carefully, but again, get your biggest chicken soup pot or whatever it is. Doesn't matter whether it's meaty or milky. You boil it up with water before you put the utensils in. Then you put the utensils into the boiling hot water, assuming you haven't used them for 24 hours beforehand. So you leave them aside before. Also to make sure that they're clean before. So again, rinse them off in cold water or something. You know, wash them off with soap, cold water beforehand. They're submerged, clean into the boiling hot water. Momentarily, doesn't need to be a long time. If there are a lot of them together, then it's worth moving them around or putting fewer in. Again, all of this done carefully, please. But all you need to do is put them into the boiling hot water while it's really bubbling, and ideally then rinse off with cold water again. Although if you forget, that's not the worst thing, but ideally rinse off with cold water after they come. Okay, so that's metal utensils. This is full metal utensils. Okay, so you can see over here we have utensils with pieces attached. So those are again more challenging because of the join, because of the parts where the join is. And again, I would say that with Pesach, we tend to be much stricter when it comes to Pesach. If that is your milky knife, let's say, for instance, and you accidentally cut a piece of meat with that milky knife, then I think you could say that there's only one small part of the knife that requires kashering, and if it's still kashered up in this by submerging it into this boiling water.
Rabbi, can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
It's known for people to have a vegetable patch, a herb patch, a salad patch in their gardens. My mum, bless her, had a cutlery patch.
Right.
Where every so often you go in the garden and you see a knife sticking out of the ground. Now, is that a bubbermeister? I think it was because she put either a milkaker knife in the...
So I'll stop with Anna because we briefly discussed it last week, and I actually should have put a slide in this week again. On one leg, very briefly, it's not exactly a bubbermeister, but in the 21st century, it's not really applicable. What the Shulchanach does talk about something thoroughly into the earth. But basically what that is designed to do is you stab it into the earth in order to remove residue. In 2021, my strong recommendation is if you have non-kosher or, let's say, milk residue on a meat knife, accidentally wash it off with cold water and soap. That's by far the better way of doing it in 2021. And then you kasher it if needed separately. So the plant pot was not for kashering, it was for removing residue. And as I said, nowadays, that's definitely not the best way to do that.
Thank you.
But yes, good question. It's not just your mother. Everybody's mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, whoever it was, has done this before. Yes. All right, so sinks. So how do we kasher a sink? So again, sinks, no one cooks in the sink, right? It doesn't, but you do spill things into a sink occasionally, certainly for Pesach. You know, we've had, we've been draining the pasta, bits of hot pasta fall in the sink, so then you need kashering for Pesach. You accidentally, for example, pour your hot chicken soup down the milky sink, or your, we'll come back to holiday, let's say you're away on holiday, and you want to kasher the sink, we'll talk about whether you really need to kasher the sink on holiday or not. But let's say you want to kasher the sink when you're away on holiday. What you need to do is pour boiling water onto the sink, assuming it's a stainless steel sink or some sort of metal sink. Then all you need to do is pour boiling water around all the different parts of the sink. It's a very big sink. Sometimes you need to reboil the kettle, and you can do it in sections. You can do it in stages. It needs to be done in one go. Certainly if you're doing the sort of draining board as well, I often find it takes me maybe like one, two, three kettle fulls to sort of really do the whole part. And again, this should be done carefully, should be done safely. We often use big towels around to make sure, and a reminder that the water in the towel also is very hot for a while afterwards. So again, please do be careful, but all that is required is just pouring boiling water on every part of the sink. So that means all the sides, all the part at the bottom, the plug hole, the draining board, all those parts need to be need to have boiling water poured onto them. And again, ideally, rinsed off afterwards as well. Countertops. Okay. So countertops, again, just need to have boiling water poured on them. Most of the time we're talking about a person moving into a house or a flat, you know, where you don't know what the countertop has been used for before and you want to kasher it. So I'll say that again, generally just requires boiling water as before. What material are you allowed to kasher? What sort of countertop materials are you allowed to kasher? There are quite a few. There are quite a lot of materials that you're allowed to. I found a good list over here on this reputable website. My word of warning over here, because I've had this so many times, but people tell me, when I bought this countertop, the fellow in the shop told me that I never need to kasher this. And I try to explain that salesman will tell you anything you want to hear, okay? So he may be right, he may be wrong, but it's never really, I would just say it's not worth taking into account. If you're thinking of buying something and the salesman is telling you X, Y, or Z, worth checking with a reputable halakhic authority before going with his word on it. But assuming you have that countertop and it needs kashering, there are many, many different types of countertops. Generally, non-porous stone, those sorts of things, granite, marble, all those sorts of things will be kasherable and will need to be kashered. Sorry, a lot of salesmen like to tell you it doesn't need to be kashered. It does need to be kashered, but it can simply be kashered just by pouring boiling water on the top of it. Okay, fridges, freezers, all those sorts of things. You don't cook in them. They don't tend to get very hot things in them. They don't need to be kashered. Even if you did accidentally get some hot something onto it, you're very unlikely to have any hot something back into it. So you're not going to be eating something hot from the fridge either, and therefore that's also not problematic. But they should be cleaned very well before use again. Let's say, for example, you're moving into a new house, and non-kosher ingredients probably been in the fridge, or for Pesach, should be cleaned very, very well, but don't need to be kashered. The shelves, but none of it needs to be kashered at all. Okay, any questions or queries before we move into a holiday mood?
Yes, I have. So what happens? So it's covering your work surface if you don't have a kasherable one. Is that okay? That's my first question. And my second question is, and you may have explained it and I've missed it, but why do you have to rinse them in cold water after you've kashered them?
Okay. I'll deal with the second question, but it's quite an involved thing, but the short answer is basically to stop the taste being reabsorbed with the hot water that's on them. So the authorities recommend rinsing it off. But it's quite an involved intricate discussion. As I said, it's not, if it didn't happen, I wouldn't worry about it. In backwards order, in terms of covering the work surfaces instead of kashering it, so for example, for Pesach, as an example, Pesach, the general rule, I would say the accepted practice, is that if you're using a thick cover, then you wouldn't need to kasher it. But a lot of thin covers do tend to tear at some point. And so for Pesach, they do tend to be quite strict. And so for a thin cover, many people will kasher first before they put the thin cover on top. We tend to use a thicker cover and don't kasher at all. Obviously, in principle, once it's kashered, it's kashered. So doesn't need to make, and once it's covered as well. So it doesn't make a difference. But with a thin cover, things do tear. Things get holes in them over the course of Pesach. We found, let's say you cover with a sort of a plastic sheet or something, it's very likely to end up getting holes in it at a certain point. Yeah. And therefore, I would recommend covering with something a bit thicker. So a bit thicker than that. Okay. Yeah, you cover your
raise hand. Raise hand. Down.
All right. Yes. Mara.
No, it's me this time.
Sorry.
On Pesach, when we've cleaned the fridge, we've always covered it with plastic liners.
Right.
Do we not need to do that?
Okay. I was going to answer and then say this, but I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to say this instead. We're going to have a Pesach Q&A just before, like a week before Pesach. So I'm going to leave it there. In general, I would say all of this kashering is more applicable to more general kashering. So let's say from non-kosher to kosher rather than Pesach. Pesach, we tend to have a few leniencies, there are a few scriptures because Pesach are very significant. So as a general rule, let's take it back. If you move into a home and you clean the fridge well, you never need to kasher it. You never need to cover the shelves. So again, for Pesach, yes, there is a strong custom to do so. We cover our shelves, but obviously, in principle, once it's clean, it's clean. So that's a bit fine. I would say that for Pesach questions, we're going to leave them for a few weeks' time. Okay. Pesach questions, we're going to leave them for a few weeks. Okay, he's ready to go on holiday. You know again? Okay. So we're gonna for our holiday, we're gonna assume that we've got some nice villa like this, right? Some nice sort of Airbnb or whatever it may be, some place that we've rented out. Okay, when it comes to hotels, okay, that's obviously a different thing altogether. And and you know, there are lots of other ways that we're talking about restaurants or things like that. So it's obviously sort of adding in more complications and applies to will apply to general life as well. So that's something which is very, very different. But we're going to try and do the sort of simple way of going away to an Airbnb or a rented place, where we're going to assume that it's real non-kosher, that the last residents were, you know, every night having parties of whatever it is, pork chops and shrimp or whatever they're having, and it's real non-kosher, the whole place from top to bottom. So what exactly do you need to bring with you? What exactly do you need to do in the place? What exactly do you need to sort of manage in order to do that? And we'll also mention a little bit about food and things like that a little bit later on. Okay, so let's start with kashrut. So coming back to everything that we've just been through, right? I would say that as a general rule, there's not much that you need to kashrut on a holiday, and therefore I would generally not do it. But you do need to be conscious. So for instance, an oven, right? An oven you can kashrut. Oh, actually, oven was from the previous thing, really. Traditional oven is a little bit different. So ovens, according to the more lenient, but I think, you know, common opinion, if you turn your oven onto its full temperature for a significant amount of time, then let's say an hour or so, then many would consider that kashrut, assuming it was cleaned beforehand, right? It was cleaned beforehand, not been used for 24 hours ideally, although it doesn't make a huge difference that. If you turn your oven on, then that's kashrut. When it comes to a holiday home, I wouldn't bother, but it doesn't even need to double wrap. Okay, double wrap. So you should double wrap everything before it goes in. This is bound in halakha. That is not a bubamai, so the idea of double wrapping. And again, it's because of holes, leaks, all those sorts of things. They're pretty common, particularly when we're talking about wrapping something. It does happen, and therefore everything should be double wrapped. Now, the utensil counts as one wrapping. So for instance, if you're using, a silver foil dish, right? To hold your, I don't know, whatever it is, your salmon, right? You're putting in this oven. So the silver foil dish is one layer, and therefore you wrap one additional layer underneath and two layers on the top, and that's considered to be double wrapped. Sinks, also probably not worth kashering, but should be aware that means that one should really not be ideally washing up in hot water. To try and do it cold or lukewarm, you know, sort of really not so hot. And again, try to avoid having things sitting in the sink, let's say with, you know, certainly food residue or anything like that. Try to avoid things sitting in the sink for a long time, certainly not with hot water. So sink, I wouldn't kasher, but again, just be conscious how one uses it. Stovetop, relatively simple to kasher. And if you're bringing your own pot with you, which some people do, bring one simple pot, you know, one sort of relatively big pot or a pasta or rice or whatever it may be, then again, very simple, fill up a little bit of water from the tap, put it on top of the stovetop, turn the stove on for, assuming it's clean, turn the stove on for 20 minutes, and that's that, right? Very simple, kashered, done. You could, you know, very, very, very quick, very easy. But again, word of warning, I don't know if people do this anyway, but if things fall onto the, you know, fall out of the pot, I would not eat them afterwards. Again, whether you do that or not. But in this sort of place, I wouldn't do that. Fridge, freezer, again, same thing. Choose a shelf, as we mentioned before, clean it off. As long as it's clean, then that's fine. Some people like to keep things in bags. Again, once it's clean, it's clean. Doesn't make a huge difference. Countertop, again, I personally find it's not worth splashing water around the whole place, you know, making a mess and getting into trouble. But what that does mean is that one should avoid putting hot things down directly on the countertop. So have a sort of a mat or a towel or something that's going to be in between the hot utensil that you're putting down. So again, you take your whatever it is, your stuff out the oven or off the stove or whatever you've done with it, and just try and have a mat down or a towel, something along those lines, so that it doesn't touch the countertop directly. Okay, so it doesn't touch the countertop directly. And finally, microwave. Again, is it really necessary? If you can't get by without it, so you can come back to what we mentioned earlier, that you can kasher it, the cup in the microwave, 10 minutes, and ideally wrap the plate as well. But we tend not to bother using the microwave when we're away. Okay, so that's in terms of kasher. Now, in terms of what you can use, okay, so this is a similar thing. Okay, this is what we just mentioned, the countertops use the cold and hot utensils down with a cover, sinks generally use the cold. Utensils, and we'll stop for questions after this. In theory, you can use the utensils for cold things. So for instance, cereal bowls, spoons, those sorts of things, glasses, all those, anything that you find there. If you're going to use it for cold food, a salad, then you could use that. Things like knives, forks, and graters, many people suggest that one should avoid, particularly when talking about using pressure to cut, and where you can get residue in sort of, you know, like, let's say, serrated knives and things like that. Then generally, you tend not to avoid them even for cold things. But obviously, anything that's hot, that within the apartment, within the flat, even though they've left pots, pans, all those sorts of things, then mugs, whatever it may be, then I would say not to use them. And I wouldn't start kashering their stuff. Again, in theory, you can follow the same principles as before, but usually simply just to have one pot, and then you can usually get by with disposables or something else. And that's what we tend to do. We find that to be the simplest thing. Okay, let's come. Oh, all right, we'll mention barbecues and then we'll come back to the food. We'll stop for questions after this. Okay, so barbecues. So they are obviously difficult to kasher because they tend to have a lot of food caked on. Now, while it's true that food is not really edible, you often have sort of stuff within, right? So let's say you have a big clump that looks very charred on the outside, but actually once it starts cooking, so within that charred clump is quite juicy stuff that tends to get absorbed into your food. It's really food on food, it's very, very problematic to do, and therefore we don't use a barbecue, but you can use the actual surface itself. So for instance, if you have a disposable barbecue, you can sit it on top of the barbecue, or somebody will bring their own grill top to go on the top as well. And again, the lid can also be problematic. So sometimes even if you're using your own barbecue, if you close the lid, then the lid also has all this sort of grease sitting at the top of the lid. So that can also be problematic, and therefore generally shouldn't do that. But otherwise, holiday barbecues are well worth doing. Lots of fun. Very, very good. Okay. Any questions? We'll pause there for questions before we go on to food and other specifics. Okay, great. Doing well. Okay, so in terms of the food, you can actually, we find, get loads and loads and loads of different food. I mean, obviously, again, just like we buy food in whatever supermarket, whatever local supermarket we do here, without an extra, right? You can do the same thing. We're talking about, let's say, in England and in most countries in Europe. Right, when you go further afield, it can be a little bit more difficult. So for instance, milk is a classic example. Milk, you know, in England, the UK, I should say, or Europe, is fine. But when you go into, let's say, for instance, in India, as an example, I think, you know, I don't think that the standards are necessarily the same. And I probably would, I don't know much about milk in India, but I would imagine it's probably much more problematic as an example, and certainly for each country you've got to check. But generally speaking, let's say in Europe, coffee, tea, fruit, vegetables, rice, pasta, all those sorts of things, right, all the sort of stuff that we could generally buy in supermarkets here, right, you can buy there as well. And that's fine, just, use it as you would here. Bread. So bread is an interesting one where bakers will often tell you that they that it's only flour, it's only water, there's only flour and water, and it's very basic. And that may be true. Again, I'm not an expert, but from my little research, there are certainly French places. I remember speaking to someone recently about this. A lot of French places will sort of line will line the baking trays with sort of grease the baking trays, right? So although the bread itself, yes, is flour and water, the baking trays are often greased with something that may well be non-kosher. Again, it's just worth generally trying to find a good hechsher, or you find a local, in a lot of European places, you can find a local rabbi who will know the facts better than the salesman who will always tell you what you want to hear. A local rabbi will often tell you what you should hear, in a sense, or sort of what the actual facts are, and they'll know much better whether a certain bakery is problematic or not problematic. Again, potentially bread is a good one. Fish is another great one. I've taken a little snapshot of this website, which is I think run by the London Bet Din, where they have lists of not just the kosher fish, but the translations for many different countries. So you can see here the translation for these sorts of fish in Cyprus or the Czech Republic, if anyone's planning on going there. But if you go down the list on this website over here, you can find all sorts of translations. Very, very helpful, very useful to use when you go around places. All of these fish are, as they said, they say over 21 different countries. All these fish are kosher, can be bought. They should be bought with the skin on, so you should be able to see the scales. Now, they do tend to descale fish. You can usually find one or two scales still sort of sticking to the skin, and that's fine. So as long as you're buying it with the skin, then that's fine. Now, what about things, let's say you come to the flat and they've already got, let's say, an open packet of, coffee, right, as an example, right? So they've got an open packet of coffee. But I would say that open stuff is a bit more difficult, it's a bit more challenging, because again, you dip from here and to there, and once something is open, or an open, let's say, an open bottle of ketchup, right? That's another good example. So open bottle of ketchup, I can tell you that if there were children who were the last family to use that flat and they had a nice pork chop for supper, that ketchup bottle definitely was squished into the pork chop before it went back into the fridge. That's definitely what happens at our table, although the ketchup in theory is coming out the bottle onto the plate, it tends to find its way onto the plate itself if children were there. So there's some open things are often a little bit more problematic. And finally, while we're talking about food, and then again, we'll stop for questions or comments or just holiday ideas, if anyone has any holiday ideas, is kosher symbols, right? You can find kosher symbols all over the world. Now, I'll say that kosher symbols, leaving aside the politics, which of course does tend to happen a little bit, in principle, there are, again, even without the politics, there are definitely problematic symbols, and there are symbols which are fantastic. And as an example, these symbols, which you can find across the world, are very good. This is just a small selection of the very good symbols. There are many, many others as well. I've listed here some classic ones that you'll find in a lot of places, certainly if you go in America, even outside of, the classic Jewish areas, New York and Florida and whatever, you'll find these symbols all over products in supermarkets. OU, Kroke, OK, Starke, mega, mega, mega kosher organizations. And you'll often find them in Europe as well, right? So it's worth sort of sometimes having a link there are a few different websites. I think the CRC, as an example, the Chicago Rabbinical Council, has a link to a lot of symbols which they say are reliable. They're not saying, they're not saying which ones are or aren't, but they will give you a guide as to which ones are good, and you can often sort of check them up while you're out and about. So it's worth remembering. But just to give you an example of a kosher symbol, which is definitely not, I'm not going to say which one it is, definitely not good, and nothing to do with politics. But someone recently showed me a kosher symbol, and I didn't know much about it actually. So I tried to do a bit of research into it. So there's a rabbi who's listed as the rabbi who gives the kashrut for this organization, right? So I looked it up, tried to get in touch. Anyway, I found an obituary for him from 2009, right? So the rabbi who gives the hechsher had died in 2009, I also managed to find, actually this is with the help of a friend, actually found this for me and sent me a link. You can buy the labels on Amazon, right? So anyone can give this Hersher if you want. You just buy it on Amazon and stick it on, right? So again, that's a classic example of a kashrut organization where maybe it was reputable once upon a time, but you know it's very easy nowadays to sort of you know get something that looks a bit Jewish and says kosher, and no one's really paying attention to what is or is not going into. Okay, I think that's really all I wanted to say. Food, I think my general principle with all these things is definitely possible. It's very doable. Going away nowadays, I think keeping kosher is perhaps, I wouldn't say easier than ever, because products can be very, very complicated nowadays, but it's definitely something which with a little bit of planning, it can be doable in countries across the world. My in-laws are great travelers. They have been to dozens of countries across the world, and you know, managed to keep kosher, as far as I know, in all of them. This is definitely doable. In some places, they actually love accommodating you. I believe that they had they went to an Indian hotel, which wanted to accommodate them and bought new utensils for them and gave them a chef. To sort of cook them whatever they wanted, and they would sort of stand in the kitchen and show him what to put in the eggs for breakfast or whatever it was. So again, a lot of places would be very, very accommodating, and general rule is it's very, very doable and just requires a little bit of planning, a little bit of forethought, thinking about what are some of the issues that we're going to come across and how can we manage to sort of overcome them in order to make sure that this holiday is going to be a lot of fun and kosher to boot. Okay, I think that's okay, so that's really, I think we covered all of this stuff. Did we cover all of this? Yeah. Okay, so any questions, any final thoughts, any, as I said, holiday recommendations, places people are thinking about going, wishing they're going?
I liked your last story, and I've come across that before where people have been away and the hotel people they've been to have bought new utensils for them. Would you be comfortable? I mean, just going back to the tovaling thing, would you be happy with someone eating off utensils not tovaled if they've been bought just for that purpose by a non-Jew, for instance?
So the general, so tovaling, just as a recap, I think we briefly mentioned it last time, but a recap for those, tovaling is a commandment that you're required to do for utensils that are owned by a Jew. So what that means is that it does not render the food non-kosher, right? It does not render the food non-kosher, but it does mean you should do it. I wouldn't eat off. I wouldn't eat ideally off utensils which have not been tovaled, but as I said, it doesn't render the food non-kosher. So all you need to do is transfer it onto something else and then you can eat it. That's number one. And number two is it's only required, tovina is only required when it's owned by a Jew. So if, for instance, the hotel is buying a new pot and pan, all you need to tell them is, I'm not taking that home, right? Thank you very much for buying it. You can keep it when we're finished. It's yours. I appreciate you buying it so it's, you know, for us to use while on holiday, but it's your pot and pan. So it belongs to the hotel, belongs to the non-Jewish hotel, and you don't need to total it. It doesn't require that mitzvah to be done on it at all. Martin, I think Martin has a hand in.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, Rabbi, can you share these slides with us and also the ones from last week?
Pleasure.
It'd be quite useful just to have a reference point for...
With pleasure, yeah, sure.
Thank you.
No worries. Very happy to send them out. And there are lots of other, by the way, sorry, there are lots of other great links online as well, as with the kashrut symbols, right? You've got to make sure that the website is reputable as well. But I'm happy to, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. But there are a lot of good reputable websites, UK-based, America-based, Israel-based, that have that have a lot of good information on, you know, on holidays, on kashering, right, all those sorts of things. Very, very, very useful and very helpful if that's something you're looking for as well. Okay. Oh, I should stop sharing the screen as well, so we can see everybody. Anybody on?
It's part of the great fun of going on holidays sometimes, is searching in the local supermarkets for kosher stuff.
Right. It's also a good way to stop the kids from asking for all sorts of, because generally the best looking products are the ones with the most ingredients, which are the most problematic. So all the sort of, you know, exciting looking things. You tell them you can have an orange, you know, or you can have a lettuce, but so I go away on holiday, it's much easier to avoid. Whereas, you know, in all the kosher shops here, they know that they're fine to take the sort of the other stuff.
Okay.
I went to Madrid the Pesach on business, and I'd taken with my food all vacuum packed in the bottom of my case, etc., etc. And when we got there, our customer turned around, I've got the place to take you, you don't need any of that. And he takes me to this restaurant, which I have to say, everybody had their sit hanging out, the big hats, kippah, black kippah. It was a pucker, it was next door to the butcher.
Right.
And he booked us in, so I actually had a kosher meal in Madrid over Pesach.
Very good.
It was excellent.
Very good. No, it's nice. There's a lot of places. There's a lot of places you go. And the challenge with us for these is when you go away, a lot of the restaurants are often the most expensive places to go. I went traveling with friends when we were 18. We went to Italy and we took loads of food with us. And there were good restaurants there, but it just wasn't in our saved and scrimped budget for going away. So we were sort of backpacking a bit more. So we avoided the hotels on the way. I mean, the restaurant on the way and the hotel. Okay. Any other comments, thoughts?
I think so.
Gerald's going to give us the lowdown on restaurants in South Florida. What's the best places to go if you're there?
Rabbi, can I ask you a question not related to holidays?
Sure.
I believe it's a principle not to have fish and meat on the same plate.
Right.
Something that Dee rigidly enforces. Why?
That's a good question. Basically because the Gemara says one shouldn't. It is a little bit debated nowadays because the Gemara seems to give the reasoning for it as being a health reason, and obviously, you know, with more advanced science nowadays, there are people who say that does that really apply? So there are people who are more lenient about meat and fish nowadays because the Gemara seems to give the reasoning as science based or, you know, health based. But I would say generally the general approach is that once the sort of Talmud seems to say that it's forbidden, that we tend not to do it. So I would say generally we don't. There are those who are a little bit more lenient about it nowadays. The Sfardim, by the way, do the opposite, I think, unless I'm mistaken. So I think the Sfardim are in the same way that we meat on a Torah level. It's only meat, not chicken, that can't be mixed with milk. But we extend that, the rabbinically, that has been extended to include chicken as well. I believe Sfardim extend that to include fish as well. So I think they don't have fish with milk, unless I'm mistaken. Well, certainly many Sfardim don't have fish with milk. So they have it the other way around.
But if you go to Kaifeng, for example, you can order a fish dish and a meat dish. They will serve it together. You can eat them together.
That's interesting.
So...
I wonder if the Hesher is aware of that. I'm sure it must be.
Yeah.
That's unusual. Oh, you mean because it's the sort of restaurant where you get everything, as it were, on the table, and you sort of, it's like a buffet style, you mean?
Yeah, you'll order a series of dishes and you can mix whatever you like.
Right. That's really interesting. But no, I haven't thought about that. There are places which when they have it at Kiddush, actually put up signs to sort of tell people not to mix them together. So you sort of have your hearing and your children at Kiddush, and good place to put up signs to do. I think it would do the simplest thing is you have to have a whiskey between each one. So it's, no one ever complains about that. No one ever complains. About that. Yes.
Thank you.
No worries. Lovely to see everybody. I'm going to stop the recording.